last August, and it has been nearly 10 months ago that the NFL and the lawyers representing the thousands of former players who had sued over concussions struck a deal that would resolve the claims not just of the people who sued, but all retired players. And even now, players can get in on this. If you're retired at the moment, the settlement receives preliminary approval from Judge Anita Brody. You're part of the class that will participate in what initially was $765 million, $765 total, $675 was going to be available for any players who have severe cognitive impairment. Well, what happened was Judge Anita Brody did not provide preliminary approval to the settlement back in January. She had concerns that there wouldn't be enough money there to cover all of the claims that could be made by every former NFL player who is still alive. And also, if a guy dies and he has evidence of chronic traumatic encephalopathy, his family would be entitled to some type of monetary payment then. So the NFL's position and the plaintiff's lawyer's position was, yeah, there'll be enough there. We had our actuaries crunch the numbers, and we are content and satisfied that enough money will be there to pay all claims. However many claims there are, we've got it covered with the $675 million. Again, it's just a piece of the total $765 million settlement. That was their argument, and my reaction to that was, well, NFL, if you're that sure that $675 million is going to be enough, why not just say, you know what? If it happens to be more, and we don't think it will be, but if it happens to be more, sure, we'll cover it. I mean, that's the easy position to take. Like, if your spouse asks you to do something that you know you're never going to have to do, why fight her over it? Just say, sure, yeah, okay, fine. If that ever happens, sure, I'll do it. Plane ever crashes into the backyard, sure, I'll clean it up. Of course, that could happen. I live near an airport, so I guess that could happen. And hopefully I'd be alive to clean it up if it happened. But anyway, what the hell was I talking about? Oh, I mean, it was an easy position. And if the NFL isn't willing to say we'll cover anything in excess of the money available, then maybe there won't be enough money available. If the NFL has any concern, then you can't believe them when they say that the money will definitely be available. So after several minutes of making very little sense, I can tell you that the NFL and the plaintiff's lawyers have announced that a new proposed settlement has been tendered to Judge Brody, and that the NFL is not limiting in any way its potential contribution. It's the smart thing. It's the right thing. And really, if it ends up blowing up on the NFL, that'll be a long time from now, and probably all of today's owners will have handed their teams off to someone else by then. So that's another benefit from this. You're tying someone else's hands down the road. So it's the easiest way to get this case ended. It's the easiest way to avoid what could be a huge potential liability for the NFL. And here's the thing. It doesn't guarantee that this is all going to go away, because players will still have the right to opt out, and that's part of the process that will come after Judge Brody gives preliminary approval. And at this point, there's no reason to think she won't, other than she had some concerns about language in the settlement agreements that also released claims against the NCAA. I don't know that that's going to pass muster. But the main concern was, will there be enough money for the players who have conditions that fall under the agreement? And now that concern's gone. There definitely will be enough money because the NFL is backing it up. And it looks like the label for getting benefits, severe cognitive impairment, in the press release, I don't see severe. I just see cognitive impairment. So it could be that guys who don't have serious problems, severe problems, may be entitled to some form of compensation as well, which could make the total fund exceed $765 million, the total package the NFL was willing to put on the table. But whatever it is, it's still a great deal for the NFL, because the ultimate outcome, if there had been a verdict against the league, could have been crippling, and there's still the potential that there will be some verdicts against the NFL by some of the players who decide to go forward. And since we're already in court, let's stay in court. Specifically, Aldon Smith, the 49ers star linebacker, 42 career regular season sacks and 43 regular season games. We'll be back in court the day after the 49ers reconvene for training camp. And you know, we talked about this last night on NBCSN. Not a whole lot of attention given to the fact that Aldon Smith faces up to 4 years in jail after pleading no contest to multiple felony weapons charges and a DUI charge from last September. Now, as I understand it, sources close to Aldon Smith expect that there will be no jail time if he stays out of trouble between now and July 25th, which should be a sure thing, but hell, you never know in the summertime when you're not within the structure of a team. But if he stays out of trouble for the next 6 weeks, he should get no jail time. That doesn't mean he'll get off scot-free as far as the league is concerned. A suspension is fully expected by those close to Alden Smith, regardless of what happens at the sentencing hearing, which means week one, San Francisco 49ers most likely won't have Alden Smith, whether it's because he gets jail time or whether it's because the NFL suspends him. He's had multiple violations under multiple policies, and yes, he missed time voluntarily when he went to rehab last year, but those felony weapons charges with the no contest plea, that tells me there will be a multi-game suspension based on NFL precedent, and we won't see Alden Smith when the season begins. When the season begins, we will see the Eagles in their second year under Chip Kelly. And I don't understand why it's a big deal that Chip Kelly moved on from DeSean Jackson, and now we know that Chip Kelly moved on from Jason Avant because they didn't buy in. They didn't submit. That's what you ultimately have to do. And it's refreshing to see that football coaches can still be football coaches. You know, now with players making considerably more, at least some players making considerably more than the coaches, the players have power. The players have control. If they don't like what the coaches are saying, the coaches at a certain point have to kind of slink away and let the player have their way. Well, not in Philadelphia. Chip Kelly's made it clear that if you don't buy in, you're going to be gone, regardless of who you are, regardless of what you've done, and regardless of how much you're supposed to make and how much bonus money you've already been paid. We'll find a way, because I'd rather have 53 guys who all buy in than 52 guys who buy in and one superstar who doesn't, which causes the other 52 to think, do I really have to as well? So it's not shocking. It's not new. If anything, it's a throwback. It's an old-school football coach mindset. You're given the keys to the franchise, especially for Chip Kelly, who also has final say over the personnel. You're running the show. This is your team. You run it as you see fit. And that may be the best way to be successful as a team, regardless of who the individual parts are. If you make sure that the players understand it's my way or it really is the highway, then you're going to have guys who want to be there. And maybe you're going to have to make some tough decisions. Maybe some of your star players like DeSean Jackson are going to end up playing for a division rival. But ultimately, the guys who are in your clubhouse, in your locker room, on your team are going to be behind you. And that's one of the keys to getting the most out of a team when you've got 11 guys on the field at any given time. When we come back, time to talk a little more Johnny Football. Is all of this stuff, all of the noise from guys like Brady Quinn, Joe Namath, Emmett Smith, is it getting through to Johnny Manziel? And what's happening at the Rookie Symposium? You know, they hold it now in Canton, Ohio. And Mary Kay Cabot, who covers the Browns for the Cleveland Plain Dealer, keeping a close eye on what's happening at the Rookie Symposium. She'll join us in segment two. And then we'll talk to you. And I'm really hoping you come through today with some phone calls. All of a sudden, just no phone calls yesterday. Hopefully we'll get some today. We'll see what happens with that before we talk to you. We'll talk to Mary Kay Cabot. We know she'll be calling in. We can't do this interview. It would not be an effective interview over text or Twitter. So we'll get Mary Kay on the phone. We'll be back after the break. This is PFT Live. The Cleveland Browns have gone from being perennially irrelevant to all of a sudden very relevant, not necessarily for reasons that they should be relevant, because we all want to know what Johnny Manziel's up to when he's away from the football field, and surprisingly quiet since the Browns finished their offseason program. Of course, this week he's caught up with the Rookie Symposium. It's mandatory attendance. That doesn't mean that crazy things can't happen. We've heard of some stories in the past, and joining us now to let us know whether there's any good stories so far about Johnny Football at the Rookie Symposium, Mary Kay Cabot at the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Anything happening so far? Johnny Football spraying champagne on the busts at Canton? Anything good to report?
Well, we will just have to see, because the AFC rookies are reporting today for their segment of this NFL Rookie Symposium. So it really hasn't started in earnest for them yet. I think they have some seminars that get rolling tonight. And then on Friday, we will see them in Berea at the Browns facility for their Play 60 Youth Clinic.
Now, you have been talking to some of the guys who are there, NFC guys at a Play 60 event on Tuesday of this week, and we'll talk more Johnny Football, but I'm intrigued by a guy who could have become Teddy Football, or at least Teddy Cleveland, Teddy Bridgewater, saying after the draft that he told his agent he didn't want to play for the Browns. Now he is backpedaling, I think. You got the comments from him. Explain what he had to say yesterday.
Well, yeah, this is kind of an interesting storyline because we had heard all along that Browns general manager Ray Farmer really loved Teddy Bridgewater. They did a study that was actually started with Joe Banner and when he was here as the Browns CEO, and their analytics people came to the conclusion that Teddy Bridgewater would be the most NFL-ready and likely to be the most successful. So there was some thought going in that the Browns might draft Teddy. And even when they traded up from number 26 to number 2, the thinking was, are they going to draft Teddy? Well, Teddy comes out afterwards, says on the Dan Patrick Show, I don't want to play. I didn't want to play for the Cleveland Browns. I talked to him yesterday. He said, you know what, that kind of came out a little bit stronger than I really intended it. I didn't mean it quite like that. I just really, really wanted to play for the Vikings. I had a very good comfort level with North Turner. And then, you know, but the whole key to that is, did the Browns know going into the draft that Teddy did not want to play for them, and did it impact how they drafted in the first round? Teddy said he didn't think it had an impact. He doesn't believe that they knew that.
Do you know whether or not the Browns were informed or had any reason to think, have any inkling whatsoever that Teddy Bridgewater didn't want to play there? Because he said he told his agent he didn't want to play there. Do we know whether that made its way back to anyone in Cleveland?
You know what? I don't know that yet. I have not had an opportunity really to grill Ray Farmer about that. That is a question that we're going to have to pin him down on again a little bit. But I mean, you would have to think through those back channels that the inkling would be there. In addition to that, I had heard that the coaching staff really favored Johnny Manziel over Teddy Bridgewater. And so I think that Kyle Shanahan and Dowell Loggins had a major influence on this decision as well.
What's been the realistic assessment so far of Johnny Manziel based on the offseason program? It sounds like he has improved his standing. I mean, he's already leapfrogged Tyler Thigpen. I don't know how high of a bar that was. But where does he stand right now with the offseason program over?
You know, I think the key thing to remember when you're watching Johnny Manziel in these drills, it keeps coming back to me that you cannot see, you don't get the full Johnny effect when you're watching these really controlled drills. That's not when he shines. So we can talk all we want about, you know, Brian Hoyer being substantially ahead and, you know, Johnny maybe not making the quick reads and things like that. That's not what Johnny does well. When the lights come on, Johnny improvises. So, you know, I really don't think that this competition is going to be decided until those preseason games are over with. And I do think that fans coming out to Browns training camp, you know, they just might not see what they saw when Johnny was at Texas A&M, but that doesn't mean it's time to count him out just yet.
And when you say that when the lights come on, Johnny improvises, I see him there with offensive coordinator Kyle Shanahan, and the book on Shanahan is he wants quarterbacks to run the offense exactly the way he wants it. How do these two coexist with Shanahan wanting things done a certain way and Manziel being a guy who gets the most out of his abilities when things break down and he goes out and just comes up with something on the fly?
Well, Kyle has worked with so many different kinds of quarterbacks, obviously, you know, going all the way through Robert Griffin III. So he had to adapt and learn to adjust to what Robert Griffin III did well. Then he had Kirk Cousins, and he was able to manage that. So if he does what I think everybody thinks he should do, you're going to have to let Johnny be Johnny. You're going to have to let Johnny improvise. You don't draft him and try to turn him into something that he's not. So I think that they're all going to just have to let that play out. And I get the sense from Dowell Loggins, the quarterback's coach, that he's willing to showcase those skills as well. Now, you see a lot of pocket stuff going on in the OTAs and the mini camps. We'll see a lot of that in training camp as well. They're trying to get him to work within the framework and the structure of the pocket. Obviously, you have to do that very well at this level. But I do think that they will really understand the asset that they have and not try to minimize it.
And on the field, when it comes to football, the Browns for now seem to be very intent on having Manziel as number 2, and Coach Mike Pettine has said it's not insurmountable for Manziel to become the starter. But off the field, the team's attitude is do what you want, we don't care. You've got guys like Emmitt Smith, Joe Namath, and Brady Quinn calling Johnny Manziel out for his lifestyle. Does he hear that? Does Manziel in any way react and modify his behavior accordingly, or does he just say, hey, as long as the team's okay with it, I'm okay with it?
You know what? Actually, oddly enough, I think he almost has intensified the partying. The more people seem to call him out for it, it's very odd. I mean, after Vegas, which turned into be, that was Memorial Day weekend, of course, at the end of May, and that was a huge flap. You would have thought that that if the criticism got to him at all, that, you know, maybe he would have toned it down after that. Instead, it's been just the opposite. Every single weekend, we see him out, and every single weekend, we see him with a large bottle of something in his hand. So I think the message from Johnny has been, hey, leave me alone. I'm going to do what I want. Now, my take on this whole thing is, you know, maybe it's all in good fun. Maybe it's boys will be boys. Maybe it's what 21-year-olds do. But before we all go yucking it up over the inflatable swan and the money phone, you know, let's check in with him. Let's make sure that he's okay. Let's have a professional evaluate the situation. And if he checks out fine, then we can all go back to saying, attaboy. But until that time, I think there are too many red flags to just let it go.
Yeah, and how do we reconcile what appears to be binge drinking, or at a minimum endorsing a lifestyle of binge drinking, with the fact that there's a guy currently in the locker room who faces a one-year suspension minimum because of his inability to overcome substance abuse issues? Different substance than alcohol, presumably, but still, you've got the future starting quarterback and maybe present starting quarterback living a life that says, hey, be young and have fun and drink lots of champagne, and then you've got another guy who's got a very real issue with presumably marijuana. How does the team harmonize that, and is the team even trying?
Well, you know, I think it's the double standard that we have. I mean, you know, just because alcohol is so socially acceptable, and I know times are changing, you know, we are all looking at all these photos and thinking, oh, isn't this so funny? Isn't he having a great time? But, you know, like you said, he is potentially in a little bit of trouble with alcohol. Now, maybe he's not. You know, I can't make that determination. Only really Johnny can, and a professional. But perhaps he is in some sort of trouble, and people are missing it. I will say the Browns have a really great player engagement program, and I'm sure they're not saying it publicly, but I'm willing to bet that Jameel Northcutt, Russell Maryland, and the rest of the player engagement team have been checking in with Johnny about this. And the thing to remember about this, because I do get a little hammered about my opinions on this from Browns fans, is that Kevin Sumlin, his coach at Texas A&M, and his parents recommended him for alcohol counseling less than 2 years ago. So I would have to think that if they're going to do that, they have very good reason to do so, and that if 2 years later you still are seeing him at every possible opportunity with a large bottle in his hand, that's something everyone needs to take a look at.
What do we know about teammate reactions to Johnny Football's off-field lifestyle? Joe Hayden recently had some comments on radio in Cleveland suggesting the use of a phone valet so you don't have videos and images of embarrassing moments broadcast to the world. Now, that's still a step from just don't engage in the embarrassing moments in the first place, but any concern that teammates will view him differently if he doesn't take care of his business better off the field?
You know, teammates so far publicly have been saying all the supportive things. Hey, you know, he's just having a great time. Everybody does it. It's no big deal. You know, the most critical thing, and it wasn't even critical really, was what you just said about Joe Hayden saying, hey, dude, you know, everybody does it. Just have everybody put their phones away. But that's about the strongest thing that we've heard so far from anybody actually on the team publicly. Now, I haven't had an opportunity to really talk to too many guys. It's the off season, so, you know, you just don't really see guys the way you do during the season. I don't know how some of the veterans really do feel about it or will feel about it when it becomes, you know, during the season if it's an issue. We talked to Mike Evans at the rookie symposium yesterday. He said, you know what, once Johnny gets into training camp, this is not going to be an issue. He will buckle down. He's not going to be going out.
And when it is time to play the real game, season starts in early September at Heinz Field in Pittsburgh. What's your gut tell you as to who the starting quarterback will be?
You know, right now I have to say Brian Hoyer, because I really, truly believe that that's what Mike Pettine wants. That's what Ray Farmer wants. And I think that there just seems to be a real push to make that happen. I don't think they want to rush Johnny in there. But, you know, that doesn't mean – I think Johnny's going to give Brian a really good run for his money. I think there's going to be a lot of not pressure, but there's going to be a lot of attention on Johnny going in there. And you know, who knows? I don't think Jimmy Haslam will ever step in and say, hey, you know, you guys really might want to think about starting Johnny. But, you know, there's going to be a lot of pressure to do that. I still think that Mike Pettine is strong-minded enough to ignore that pressure. I think they really want Brian to start the season.
I know the organization has changed dramatically since 2007 and for some of the positions multiple times over. But is anyone thinking about the whole Derek Anderson, Brady Quinn situation where Anderson got the nod after Charlie Fry was dumped and Quinn wasn't ready yet because he held out deep into July. So they went with Anderson, who had no baggage, no burden, no worries of being benched because he knew he was going to be benched anyway. And he played incredibly well when he's not worried about getting benched because we assume he's going to get benched at some point anyway. And then you have a quarterback mess the next year and the quarterback position still trying to recover from that. Shouldn't there be concern that if you go with Brian Hoyer and a presumption it's eventually going to be Johnny Football, that maybe Hoyer plays so well Manziel can't get on the field?
Well, I think they would view that as a good problem to have. And I think that if it does get to that point, I think that they would organizationally make a decision. And then you find yourself in a, you know, maybe a Drew Brees, you know, Philip Rivers type of a situation where you have a tradable commodity. So, you know, I think they want to let it play out. The other thing to factor in here is that Brian Hoyer is coming off of a torn ACL. And we haven't even seen him in a full 11-on-11 yet. And I know that he looks really good. The footwork, the agility, everything looks good so far. But you never really know how that knee or the other knee is going to respond once you really get rolling. So I think we all have to kind of, you know, just be a little bit patient with how this might play out.
I know we call it a good problem to have. I'd rather have no problem than a good problem because for the Chargers, you could argue they didn't handle that the right way. They should have embraced Drew Brees because he's been the better quarterback and he's the guy who's potentially going to have a bust in Canton. And there's no good way out of that maze once you have two quarterbacks and the guy that you picked with the 22nd overall selection can't get on the field. Now, a bad problem for the Browns to have is Josh Gordon. We talked about him earlier. I was told recently that there's been no appeal hearing set yet, that possibly there could be some sort of a resolution. What do you know about when we're going to know something? Because if it's a one-year suspension, the sooner it starts, the better for the Browns.
You know, I would anticipate hearing something within the next couple of weeks. And like you said, it is important to get this thing resolved as quickly as possible because if they do end up with the one-year ban, the minimum one-year ban, you know, the day that they get the news, you have to go, you know, one calendar year out before he can even go back to Roger Goodell and say, hey, please let me back into your league. So time is of the essence here. And here's the other thing to consider. Even I just found this out the other day. Even if it turns out to be, say, an 8-game suspension, they have some kind of a resolution to this, and let's say it's 8 games. I was of the mind that perhaps he would be able to remain with the team for those 8 games. I have been told that is not necessarily the case, that he might still be banished because this would be really a reduction of a banishment as opposed to technically, you know, like a suspension. So there's still a good chance he would have to be away, which puts him maybe back in Houston, back home. And I think that's just a dangerous thing for him. And he even struggles when he is here and has some type of structure. So this one is definitely one to watch over the next few months.
Yeah, that's a key thing to remember. When a guy is suspended, he's still subject up to 10 tests per month, has to stay clean, or he's not going to get back in. Well, great stuff. Enjoy the Rookie Symposium. We'll be checking out your work at Cleveland.com for the Cleveland Plain Dealer, and we'll talk to you again down the road.
Sounds great. Thanks a lot.
All right, there she is, Mary Kay Cabot, Cleveland Plain Dealer, covering the Rookie Symposium. And, yeah, you know, the Browns should not complain because we're talking about the Browns a heck of a lot more than we were talking about the Browns before, and we're going to keep talking about the Browns, whether it's good problems, bad problems, no problems, ideally no problems, ideally everyone on the same page, ideally everyone knows their role. I know my role. My role right now is to shut up and invite you to pick up your cell phone device, which you didn't do yesterday. I need you to do it today. 888 237 5269. I guess I could say our phones were busted yesterday. That's why we didn't have any call. But I'll be honest with you. If you watched the show, you knew our graphics weren't working because we didn't have the Twitter questions up, but I read them to you, and hopefully I won't have to do that exclusively again today because hopefully you will call. Stick around and we'll find out whether anyone calls. This is PFT Live. There's the logo. That means we're taking questions, so let's go straight to the questions for this Wednesday, June 25, from at Gregory67. Will Adrian Wilson seal the Bears secondary up? For those of you who missed it, veteran safety Adrian Wilson, longtime member of the Cardinals, spent a year, blinked and you missed it last year, with the Patriots, signed with the Bears. Look, I don't know if he's healthy. I don't know what he's got left. I know it was a move that created some excitement last year when the Patriots picked him up, but we haven't seen him do anything. So we got to see that he's healthy, and then we'll see what he can do. Sometimes guys fall off a cliff in the NFL, and just because they have a name that suggests a past level of greatness doesn't mean they can still do it now. So I don't think Bears fans should start making reservations in the state where Adrian Wilson once played very well, because there's no guarantee you're going to Arizona, and there's no guarantee that Adrian Wilson is going to be the difference. Let's go to another question from Twitter, at 12-ounce Yingling. I like that question. I like that product. I sample that product from time to time. Lance Moore in Pittsburgh, do you see it as an upgrade at the receiver spot? And again, a name that we recognize, a guy who used to do things, but for whatever reason, the team with which he did those things doesn't want him anymore. They move on from Lance Moore. And for the Steelers, he was the break glass in the event of emergency after Jericho Cotchery spurned the Steelers and signed with the Panthers. So I don't know what Lance Moore has left. I don't know what he's going to do this year. And again, some of these guys, and we see it every year, oh, hey, that Lance Moore, that's Plexico Burress. Doesn't matter. Gone. It's over. It's done like that. Burris was going to have one more year last year with the Steelers, injured a shoulder in training camp, never to be heard from again. Currently unsigned. I'd be shocked if anyone signs him. We'll see what Lance Moore has. It's a need. Slot receiver. Heath Miller supposedly is getting back to where he was. JerMichael Finley could be a guy they sign. We'll see what Lance Moore can do. But just because a guy did something at a decent level for the Saints for all those years, Saints have moved on. Usually there's a reason for it. I know the Saints have moved on from several guys this year, but we'll see what Lance Moore can do once it's time to play for real, because he's getting up to that age where it can go very quickly. Let's go quickly to the phone lines. Travis in Indy, you're on PFT Live. What's up, Travis?
Hey, bud. Dante Moncrief. Doing good, Van. Dante Moncrief, what have you heard about him? And what's the earliest that you see him making an impact in the Colts? Thanks.
Yeah, not much so far, which I guess no news is good news. They're written all, you know, you always hear everybody looks great in the offseason program. It's only news when somebody doesn't look great, like Mike Williams in Buffalo. And I know there's a difference of opinion on that, but we'll just see what happens. Training camp is coming. Preseason is coming. The real games are coming. And for any guy who comes out of college, the real question is what happens when it's time to suit them up and play against NFL caliber competition. And that's when we realize that all this stuff about the draft process that seems like real analysis and understanding of what's going to, we just don't know. There is a qualitative aspect to it. There is a crystal ball aspect to it, and no one has the crystal ball, and anyone who thinks they do is dead wrong. Let's go back to the Twitter bag. This is a question from The Real Valverde. Is Seahawks 49ers the best rivalry of the 21st century? Well, look, we got a long way to go in the 21st century. So far, I'd say it is, although Ravens-Steelers, a pretty compelling rivalry. Not long ago, you know, Seahawks-49ers was that back end of the first Monday night doubleheader that not anybody really cared about, although I don't think Seahawks-49ers ever met there. It was like Cardinals-49ers. Those NFC West games weren't all that compelling. Not very long ago, now all of a sudden, that's the hot division. That division is as tough as any division's ever been in the NFL. And this year, Seahawks-49ers, playing, by the way, Thanksgiving night on NBC. We look at that and we say, wow, whoever wins that series, whoever emerges with the better record in the division, the better record in the conference, whoever wins a tiebreaker, they may end up with the same one loss record. That's the team that's going to have the inside track to the Super Bowl. But, you know, when you look at the issues the Seahawks have had this offseason, i.e. not many, and the issues the 49ers have had, plenty. Are the 49ers going to hold it together? They got unhappy players. They got holdouts. They've got the Alden Smith situation. He's not going to be around, I assume, I expect, I predict, for at least the first few games. Can the 49ers hold it together? Can they continue to compete with the Seahawks? Seahawks seem to be poised to not suffer from that Super Bowl hangover that you see where, you know, you've climbed to the top of a mountain and now you go back to the bottom and you're going to climb the same damn mountain again. Sometimes teams can't do that. I think the Seahawks, with Pete Carroll knowing how to press those buttons, I think they're going to find a way to be up near the top of the mountain. Can the 49ers do it as well? A lot of people assume they will. I look at what's gone on this offseason and I wonder whether they can really hold it all together. We're going to hold it together for another Twitter question. This one comes from Glonos. Minnesota Vikings have the biggest turnaround this year. Agree? I don't know. They were 5-10-1. I think the Jaguars have the potential to have the biggest turnaround because look at the division the Jaguars play in. I'm not convinced that the Texans' performance last year, the dip to 2-14 after consecutive playoff berths, was an aberration. Especially with Ryan Fitzpatrick, all due respect, i.e., here comes the, I've been using i.e. a lot, e.g., that doesn't work here. Anyway, what was I saying? Ryan Fitzpatrick, all due respect, that means, here comes the insult, is the starter for that team. I don't see the Texans being much better this year. I don't see the Titans being very good this year. The Colts are good enough to win the division. I think the Jaguars. I really do. And all you folks in Jacksonville, oh, you hate the Jaguars. You know, you'll forget about this one with me saying that if I had to pick a team right now to have the biggest turnaround in 2014, I'd say it's going to be the Jacksonville Jaguars, whether they start Blake Bortles or not. And I think they will start Blake Bortles. Another Twitter question, which means we've only had one. At least we've had a phone call today. We've got plenty of Twitter questions from C. Crawl. Did the Rams or the Cardinals do enough in the offseason to overcome San Francisco and Seattle? And if so, what specifically will give them the edge over San Fran and Seattle? I don't think the Cardinals have done enough to overcome those two teams, although we assume they're on the precipice. We assume they're ready to make the next step. I don't think the Cardinals are going to actually make the next step. I don't see the offensive line being better. I don't see the defense being better. They lost some key parts in Carlos Dansby and Darrell Washington. Yes, they can boast that they've got a better secondary with the arrival of Antonio Cromartie. I just don't believe the Cardinals are going to topple either of those teams. I've been a believer in the Rams ever since Jeff Fisher arrived, and Sam Bradford healthy, had 14 touchdown passes and 4 interceptions before tearing the ACL last year. Tavon Austin's being used all over the field. We saw what happens for him when things line up just right. If the game slows down, he can have a huge impact. Running backs aplenty. Defensive line, the fearsome foursome are back for the Rams, especially with Aaron Donald. I don't know that I'm a believer in using the second overall pick on a guy who's going to be a guard and a guy who's struggling at guard like Greg Robinson. I think the Rams are in position. They catch some breaks early, win some close games, develop some momentum. I know last year I thought the Rams were the team that could disrupt the 49ers, Seahawks dominance. This year the trendy pick will be the Cardinals. I still think it's more likely to be the Rams. And we do have another phone call. Jerry in Indiana. You're on PFT Live. What's up, Jerry?
Oh, not much. I called in. I was watching the show, and you were talking about greatest defensive backs of all time, Ronnie Lott and Sanders, Neon Dion, all of, and nobody ever mentions Rod Woodson, and don't understand that. He's probably the best all-around defensive back that ever played the game. He made a Pro Bowl as a cornerback. He made it as a safety. Hell, he made it as a return man. Can't understand why nobody ever brings him up.
Well, and I appreciate the call. We were talking about on our show on NBCSN the best defensive backs in the context of the number that they wore. Rod Woodson, not a guy who wore 21 or 24 or any of the other numbers. He's a guy who wore 26, and frankly, I can't recall whether we've done 26 yet. I don't think we have. We're doing the prime numbers series all month long. I don't recall talking about Rod Woodson, and we definitely would have talked about Rod Woodson, if and when, and if we haven't already, we will be talking about number 26. But this guy accomplished a lot of things in Pittsburgh. He was a great presence on that team in that window between Super Bowl victories. He arrived in 87. He was there for the Super Bowl appearance in 1995. Remember, he tore the ACL week one against the Lions, came back and played in the Super Bowl. They held him on the roster the entire year. He ultimately got his Super Bowl ring with the Baltimore Ravens in 2000, played for the Raiders in 2002 when they played in the Super Bowl, 11-time Pro Bowler, 6-team All-Pro. I believe he was a member of the 75th anniversary team There's going to be, yeah, he was. And there's going to be a 100th anniversary team coming up in a few years. We'll see if he gets on that. But I think he was a great player. But we weren't talking about best defensive backs per se. We were talking about the best to wear a given number. And I'm pretty convinced we haven't talked about number 26 yet. One way to find out whether we have, tune in to NBCSN, 5:30 p.m. Eastern time this week and next week, because by the end of next week, actually before Friday, because Friday is the 4th and we won't be on, we will get to all 100 numbers plus 0 and 00 will get a mention in there somewhere. You'll find out what we're going to talk about tonight on NBCSN if you tune in at 5:30 p.m. Eastern time. I know we're doing number 37 because I'm going to interview Rodney Harrison during the program, and I think we have fan voting for number 82 and number 55. We don't do all the numbers for fan vote. We just pick out a couple a day. So you can cast your ballot. You can tune in. You can check us out 5:30 p.m. Eastern time on NBCSN. Check us out tomorrow at noon Eastern time right here on PFT Live. And as always, around the clock at ProFootballTalk.com. Have a great day. See you tomorrow.